Welcome back for the third hour of Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. This will be the last hour broadcasting live here from the campus of Concordia University, Wisconsin, in Mequon, Wisconsin. Before we go on with this hour, we've had another excellent experience here as we've been in Mequon, and that is the place that my producer and I, and Tom Baker and his wife, were able to stay and eat several of our meals here. It was called the Gressley House. It's a bed and breakfast just down the road from the campus of Concordia University. John and Ruth Gressley there run that bed and breakfast, and John is quite a cook for the breakfast end. I didn't eat any of his other meals, but we had quiche Lorraine this morning, and he lays out quite a spread. It was a nice place to stay if anyone is ever up in the Mequon area, the Milwaukee area, and or if you bring up a student perhaps to visit the campus of Concordia University, Wisconsin, make sure you stay at the Gressley House. It's very close to the campus. Comfortable beds. I was, I was thoroughly delighted. And it is a genuine bed and breakfast atmosphere. I promised him I would talk about the place. So in this last hour of the program, we have two guests. Dr. Angus Manoos joins us for the first 25 minutes. Then Dr. Kevin Voss. We'll be talking about bioethics with Dr. Kevin Voss in the last 25 minutes. This first 25 minutes will require quite a bit of defining terms, and that's what we're going to start out doing here. Sometimes Christians view science as the enemy of faith. And all of us know that if reason is properly used in its servant role to faith, there really is no problem with genuine science. But what passes for science today? We're going to talk about that during this first 25 minutes. If you'd like to join us, our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Dr. Angus Manoos is a regular guest on Issues Etc. He's Associate Professor of Philosophy and Chairman of the Department of Philosophy at Concordia University here in Mequon, Wisconsin. He's Associate Director of the Cranach Institute. We are here by their invitation. And he's author of several books, including his latest called Agents Under Fire, Materialism and the Rationality of Science. Dr. Manoos, welcome back.
Glad to be here, Todd.
Let's define some terms. The big one that needs definition before we have any more words spoken here, materialism. Most people think, oh, that means I'm materialistic. I like to accumulate all sorts of things. You mean this in a very different sense, in kind of a classical sense. What is materialism?
Materialism in a philosophical sense basically says that the physical exhausts all that there really is. In other words, you might say materialism says that stuff happens. That is, that what there exists is stuff, things that have no purposes or goals of its own, and furthermore, that it simply happens. It doesn't do anything for a reason. So you have really a world of undirected causes. And then when you come to anything that appears to provide evidence for design, whether in biology or psychology or anywhere else, that really presents you with a problem. This is something that has to be explained or explained away. You have to take these seemingly purposeful things and somehow reduce them to processes that don't have any purpose.
I'm thinking about a recent guest we had on the program, and he may have been trying to summarize precisely what you said there when he talks about, he tells the story of the particles, that the materialist believes that there really is nothing but matter and matter interacting randomly with other matter, and what we see as events, purpose in life, design, even our own thinking, is really nothing more than just a very complex interaction of blind and purposeless particles. In the beginning were the particles. The particles got together by random chance. The particles began to breathe and talk, and then the particles invented the idea of God. But it's just an idea invented by the random activity of particles. Is that a good definition there?
Right, that's really the idea. And they, of course, they're stuck with a rather inconsistent notion that somehow these particles created something which has the illusion of meaning. Now you have to ask, how could anything but a person even have illusions? All right, so there's a clear problem here. On the one hand, they seem to want to deny the ultimate reality of persons, an agency. And yet, in order to explain this odd perception that we have of design, they have to say that it's an illusion or it's something that somebody thinks or false beliefs. So on the one hand, they have a desire to deny the reality of beliefs, and yet when they come to explain how we could get so confused as to think otherwise, they do so in terms of our having false beliefs, which assumes, in fact, that we do have them.
Wouldn't it be consistent to say that if my idea about God is just a certain pattern of neurons firing in my brain, and that's all any idea is, God doesn't really exist, wouldn't it be consistent to say that my idea that is the case is also just the product of random neurons firing in my brain, giving me the idea that the idea of God is an illusion? I mean, where does the illusion stop?
Right. I mean, basically what you're describing there is the most extreme form of materialism, which is the eliminative idea. An eliminative materialist actually says that what we normally consider beliefs and desires and all these other thoughts that we have don't really exist, and that the material processes are all that they really are. Now, the difficulty with this view, however, is that they make this claim on the basis of what they say science has discovered. However, what is science? Science is a certain kind of rational project. All right, scientists do things for reasons. Scientists themselves, for example, propose theories in order to explain or model events. All right, and then they offer an explanation to someone else in the hopes that that other person will understand the explanation. So science as a rational activity actually continues to presuppose that there are individuals who understand things, who propose theories, who test theories, who design experiments, and so on. And so if you say that all of these reasons are an illusion, what ends up happening with materialism is it undermines the rationality of science itself. And so one of the things that I try to show in considerable depth in my book is if you take this route, claiming that you are a scientific materialist, the problem is that the materialism actually comes in conflict with the science, because science holds itself up as the model example of rationality, but the materialism undermines the very basis for claiming that scientists are rational beings.
There's also a term that needs some explanation. That is the term reductionism. How is it defined?
Basically, the idea of the reductionist is that when you think you have two categories, you really only have one, that one category is really a special case of the other. So, for example, it might seem clear that you have both temperature and energy. And yet when you look at gases, for example, scientists tell us that you can understand the temperature of a gas in terms of the mean kinetic energy of its molecules. And so temperature turns out to be a special case of something else. Well, applying that now to the mind, the reductionist says that when you see something odd like thought is a very odd thing because it doesn't seem as if rocks point to other things, and yet thought can point to an object which it's not physically connected to. So you and I right now can think about the Eiffel Tower or John Gresley's Wonderful Breakfast, even though John Gresley's Wonderful Breakfast is not physically present in front of us right now. Okay? So there's this ability of thought to be directed to something else. This is a problem for materialism because it seems like ordinary physical states aren't like that. Even sophisticated states of a computer aren't like that. There's something in the computer's memory, but it doesn't point to anything except in the mind of the human programmer or the person reading output. So what the reductionist has to do is take these mental states as sort of problems and somehow say that although this looks different because these thoughts are about something, they can be reduced to processes that aren't about anything. In other words, it's the task of showing how meaning can reduce to unmeaning, to things that don't mean.
So when the researcher says, why do people believe in God? What is this belief in God in its essence, which seems to be common to the human race? And he takes people and puts them in a CAT scan and looks at the neurons of their brain firing and says, all of them show this certain characteristic pattern when they're thinking about God. Ergo, the idea of God is really just another form of electrical activity in the brain. It is not the existence of God that spurs it. It's just electrical
right.
activity.
Right, and the problem with that kind of proposal is that you can model everything that's going on in the brain in terms of these neural nets and these mappings from one state of activation to another in completely impersonal terms that don't mean a thing. They aren't about anything. You can capture everything the scientist wants to say without ever talking about what it's about. And yet the key thing about thought that needs to be explained is that you can think about things. This is why we can have true beliefs and false beliefs. So that if I think that the Eiffel Tower is in Cairo, I'm thinking about the Eiffel Tower and I'm thinking something false about it. But it seems that you can give a completely full description of what's going on in the brain, and that will not capture what it is to think about something or how it can be that some of these thoughts are true and some of these thoughts are false.
Dr. Angus Manoj is our guest. We're talking about materialism and the rationality of science. He has written the book called Agents Under Fire. Feel free to join us here. We have about 10 minutes left with him. 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. If anyone wants to be brave enough here in the studio audience to venture a question that might, I don't think it's possible, but might stump Dr. Manoj, feel free to approach the microphone at any time. This seems ultimately a very futile way of conceiving of the universe, self-defeating, if you will.
Yeah, I mean, I think that Chesterton captured this a long time ago, at a tie-in with Dr. V's wonderful presentation the other day, that there's something wrong with materialism. You're trying to fit everything into one category. And Chesterton has this beautiful poetic way of saying it. He says that the materialist tries to fit the heavens into his head, and it's his head that splits. In other words, to try to say, no, the impersonal, the things that don't mean, they are ultimate and everything must reduce to that. You have a picture that's simply not adequate to reality. We know that there is thought, there is purpose, there is design, and there is reason, and it simply cannot be made to fit in there so that reality, which includes those things, will ultimately split the head of the materialist. It's kind of a Tower of Babel that's going to be knocked down. And then Chesterton says that the poet is content simply to fit his head into the heavens. In other words, the wonder here of the Christian worldview, of course we emphasize that there is matter, and of course, you know, God works through means. We're not denying the existence of matter, but we don't try to reduce everything to it. We allow reality to be fully what it is.
What are agents? You use the term there, and I suspect it means something other than some guy skulking around in a trench coat and dark glasses. What are agents?
Agents in philosophy really mean individuals who act for personal reasons. Now, the word personal is very important. A calculator might act for reasons because it's been designed by somebody who understands, you know, arithmetic and so on, but it's not the calculator's reasons. The calculator isn't trying to see if you can afford your groceries or not. It's the shopper using the calculator. So an agent is someone who has his or her own reasons for what they are doing.
So when you say agents under fire, what in essence does that mean?
What I'm saying is that picture, which is the picture sometimes derisively called the picture of folk psychology, is what's under attack from the various materialistic worldviews, either because they want to eliminate it, that picture is so embarrassing to the materialist that they'd rather deny that agents even exist, okay, or because they want to domesticate it. Naturalism is kind of weaker. It will say, yeah, okay, there are thoughts, but you know what, I'm going to find a clever way to identify them with something physical going on in the brain or the functional state of something. So the agents under fire is really saying our picture of ourselves, which really is our picture of autonomous, rational beings of a kind, is under attack from this philosophical worldview.
Let's go to the phones at 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Calling from his car, Larry is on the line. Larry, welcome to Issues Etc.
Hi, thank you. This is wonderfully interesting. And I've done a lot of reading of Einstein, and I guess I'm impressed with him because he really believed that there had to be a God. And he, in fact, at one point he said you'd have to be a fool not to, because he said there's no other way to explain it all. Sadly, he did not believe in a God who was personally involved in his life. But in talking to people sometimes, you know, who don't believe there's a God, I've come at them from that standpoint, saying, well, if you don't believe a God, then you're either, you think you're smarter than Einstein or you're an idiot.
Larry, thank you very much for the call. I saw you nodding your head when he was making reference to Einstein's ideas there. Expand on that, if you
will. Yeah, that's a wonderful example. The irony is that some of the greatest scientists have seen that in order to do science, even when you are studying material things, you have to have some basis for believing in a rational order to be discovered, a logos, if you like. And for Einstein, yeah, it was a rather impersonal thing. But then again, for Kepler, he understood the goal of the astronomer as really uncovering God's providential design built into creation. And the irony of materialism is that now, well, if you take that logos out, what reason is there to think that human beings, well, one thing, is there an order to discover? Why should there be? Why not just atoms in the void? And secondly, even if there was, why should we be equipped to detect it, discover it? And it seems that you need something like at least theism, that's to say the belief that there is a God of some kind, to structure the universe in order for science to be a rational project. And so it seems to me scientific materialism is badly named because it really undermines science. It's not science's friend.
Isn't that really the ultimate obstacle for the materialist to answer that question, why is there anything at all?
Yeah, why anything rather than nothing? Stanley Yaki likes to make that point, that the materialist is hamstrung there because obviously if you think of the universe as being this physical entity that is all there is, how can it possibly be the case that it or any state of it explains its own existence? Its origin must lie outside of itself, because if you say it's a part of the universe, well, that's another of those things that needs to be explained, and you just get to an infinite regress.
You've brought us very nicely to the nexus of a very popular subject now with your book, and that is intelligent design. What is intelligent design, and how does it figure into our conversation up to this point?
Intelligent design is a fairly new movement that wants to be completely scientific and propose purely empirical methods for detecting the presence of design in the physical universe, for example, the fine structure concepts and in biology. Also, I've applied it in my own book to the case of psychology.
Okay, so basically we're saying things appear to have been designed by an intelligence. So we will posit, at least in terms of philosophy and the observable universe, that would argue most directly in favor of an intelligent designer, not necessarily God, not necessarily the Christian God, but a cause of intelligent design.
Right. And one of the things that I emphasize in my book, my application of it, is that one of the things that particularly needs explaining is the existence of finite agents like you and me. And I know John Warwick Montgomery mentions this in his book, the Tractatus Logico-Theologicus, that the existence of contingent persons itself is something that points to a transcendent person. And I think that's really one of the strongest arguments from design there is. And it's interesting because you think of an individual agent. We are also, as Tolkien would say, sub-creators. So what's particularly interesting is not just that our logical thinking, for example, looks designed, but that also that we are designers. All right, and then we can go a little bit further than just the anonymous designer, because it seems to me that at that point this is best explained by a particularly Christian view, namely our being made in the image of God. In other words, there's an affinity between human beings and God in our creative capacity.
Dr. Manoj, in conclusion to our conversation, yesterday Dr. Veith told us what the essence of the Cranach Institute is. Very briefly, review that, and then please tell us about the latest news concerning the Cranach Institute.
Yeah, the Cranach Institute was set up to explore the implications of Lutheran theology for all of life, for the culture, and particularly to equip the laity. In other words, not just to focus on the pastors, but the laity, so that in all vocations we look at what it means to be a Christian and to think Christianly, and we also consider especially the doctrine of the two kingdoms.
And what is the latest news with regard to Cranach?
The latest news is that there's been an agreement made. This was done between President Dean Wenthe of Fort Wayne Theological Seminary and also President Ferry here. And Cranach is going to kind of move its locus of operations to Fort Wayne. And there's going to be an inaugural event March 16th and 17th. Now, this doesn't mean that Cranach will sort of stop existing at Concordia Mequon. Concordia Mequon will still be an outpost of Cranach, and we'll continue to do various activities like this one.
So, in other words, you're not moving to Fort Wayne.
No, I'm not moving to Fort Wayne. Mm-hmm. In fact, neither, as far as I know, is Dr. Veith.
What do you hope to accomplish by this, by making this move?
Well, it will mean that Cranach can have a far wider impact. We really want to have a nationwide impact. There are things that we can do well here at Mequon, such as speaker series and so on. But the difficulty that we run into is that because of Concordia's great success, for example, our dorms are always packed with students. So we can't have these nice big conferences any time that we want. We could only do them in the summer. If we move to Fort Wayne, they've told us that they have just more resources. And they also have lots of connections that we don't have and access to, you know, donors and other things that we're really not eligible for.
So then how would you summarize the goal? Because Cranach really exists, I mean, at least in church circles, as a very unique institution. How would you summarize the goals here now that this move is being made? You got 1 minute.
I would say to make Cranach a national presence that is something that affects the church as a whole, but also starts to affect people outside of Lutheranism who may be drawn to it, just as you've been very successful on your show drawing evangelicals toward Lutheranism and all the wonderful confessional concreteness it has to offer. Basically a bigger and better version of what we've been doing.
Dr. Angus Manoush, thank you for being our guest, and thank you for inviting us up here to do Issues, Etc. Dr. Angus Manoush is Associate Professor of Philosophy and Chairman of the Department of Philosophy at Concordia University here in Mequon, Wisconsin. He is the Mequon Director of the Cranach Institute and author of several books, including his latest, I am just all a-twitter with glee, waiting to read this book. I hope it didn't give me too much of a headache. The book's called Agents Under Fire. When we come back from this break, if we are nothing more than just matter randomly put together and arranged with no design, we could not do the last half hour of Issues, Etc. today. We could not answer some of the most difficult moral and ethical dilemmas that are facing us as a nation and as a people. Terry Schindler-Shivo lies in a state that some people says is dead already, and other people say, no, she's alive and she deserves to keep living. We'll be talking about her and human cloning with Dr. Kevin Voss after this.
Defending life from beginning to end. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Have you noticed that Christian preaching today is sounding more and more like a how-to manual? Have you noticed less real preaching and more pious platitudes? Have you noticed that real Bible study has been replaced with moral lessons? What's missing from so much preaching today? Learn about the proper distinction between law and gospel in our Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for February, God's No and God's Yes. To order our Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for February, call Concordia Publishing House weekdays during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040, or browse before you buy at our website, issuesetc.org. Click on the What's New section. You'll find information on God's No and God's Yes, the proper distinction between law and gospel. issuesetc.org.
Evolution's a fact.
Who made that claim?
Answers with Ken Ham, author of the best-selling book, The Lie, Evolution. Now, is it true, Ken, that most professors in secular schools and colleges present evolution as fact today?
When I went to school in the 60s and 70s, my teachers said that evolution was just a theory. However, today, you're right, evolution is being presented basically as fact. Now, people might wonder how teachers can do this when there's no evidence for evolution. Well, this has happened because secular education has become so anti-God in its philosophy, rejecting any possibility of creation. So, many educators now say there's only one option, life must have evolved. Thus, if there's no God, and life is here, well, evolution's fact. When you think about it, ultimately there are only two views of origins. Either there's a supernatural being responsible for the universe, or somehow matter formed from nothing by chance random processes and it arranged itself into what we see today. Thus, even though there's no evidence to prove evolution, to those who reject the Creator, they must believe evolution as fact because they exist. And why do so many embrace this anti-God religion of evolution? We're all descendants of the first man, Adam, whose sin was to reject God. People are humanist at heart, not wanting to be accountable to their Creator.
But doesn't carbon dating provide evidence to prove millions of years of evolution? Well, for the answer, go to our website, AnswersRadio.com, and read our free booklet, AnswersRadio.com.
This is Dr. John Tape with the Media Minute. I confess that I am no fan of heavy metal music, but some kids love this stuff. Research suggests that most children who listen to this kind of music soon get bored with it. However, studies also indicate that there is a small minority of teens who become immersed in this music and become absorbed by it. These are usually teens who have other serious problems. For these teens, this music can be very influential because it validates their self-destructive and immoral ideas. If your teen is listening to heavy metal music a lot, consider it a warning sign for other serious issues. It could even be a plea for help. Remember, our greatest help comes from Jesus Christ. He who died on Calvary's cross for you will help you and your child with any problem. This Media Minute is brought to you by the Christian Media Literacy Institute. Please visit our website at www.cmli.org.
Issues Etc. is underwritten in part locally by Bethany Lutheran Church in Fairview Heights, Illinois. Bethany Lutheran is located at 5600 Old Collinsville Road in Fairview Heights. The Reverend Randy Emmons is the pastor. Their phone number, 618-632-6906. 632-6906. Bethany Lutheran Church in Fairview Heights. www.bethanylcms.org.
Welcome back for the last 25 minutes of Issues Etc. Today we're coming to you live Thursday, the 19th of February. The last 25 minutes broadcasting live from the campus of Concordia University, Wisconsin in Mequon, Wisconsin. Our guest in this last hour to talk about two major issues in bioethics, Dr. Kevin Voss, instructor of philosophy and director of the Concordia Bioethics Institute at Concordia University here in Mequon, Wisconsin. Before we go on with our conversation, there is someone sitting here today that I need to thank. I thanked Dr. Manoj for giving us the official invitation to come up here to the campus of the university and broadcast, but that was only at the behest of Allison Kirchhoff. Allison's sitting out there. Apparently, she wrote a letter, if I'm not mistaken, trying to, or something along those lines, and that led to our invitation up here. I want to thank you, Allison. Is the daughter of Ruth and Arthur Kirchhoff. Many people who are involved with Lutherans for Life in St. Louis know Ruth and Arthur, and also in conjunction with the Vitae Society dinners that we've been doing for some time. So, Allison, thank you very much for writing the letter. Dr. Kevin Voss, welcome to Issues Etc.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
There is some news that's just come out yesterday, if I see the dateline correctly, about embryonic stem cell research. Give us the story there and your thoughts on this.
Well, researchers have done something new that they hadn't done before. They found a way to turn mouse embryonic stem cells into actually beating heart muscle cells. And that could lead to the use of embryonic stem cells in heart treatments and possibly even drugs that help the body to renew heart muscle cells of its own. This research will appear in the February 18th edition of the Journal of American of the Journal of the American Chemical Society. It's a peer-reviewed journal of the largest scientific society, the world's largest scientific society. And so it will actually signal the development of stem cells into heart cells, which is really one of the goals of embryonic stem cell research. Stem cells are cells in your body that from these cells, all different tissues, about 200 different types of tissues of your body come from. That's why they call it stem cells. It's sort of if you look at a plant. A plant has one stem, and from that stem, there are different branches. And it's the same thing with the stem cells. From the one cell, initially it's the zygote, the union of the sperm and the egg, all of the other different kinds of cells in your body will come from.
Now, this is about embryonic stem cell research. In other words, these stem cells were taken from human embryos, regardless of their origin, but in order to harvest these stem cells for the research that's being done, that embryo had to be destroyed. You read this as a bioethicist. Why is this a problem?
Right. Well, in this research, it was mouse embryonic stem cells, but it would be just one step to human embryonic stem cells. And the problem with that is in order to harvest the stem cells, you take the cells from an embryo, and in order to get the cells, you have to essentially cut the embryo apart in order to harvest the something called the inner cell mass. That's sort of a group of cells that eventually grows up into the fetus. And by doing that, you destroy the embryo, and the new life is destroyed. And that's the big issue we have with that, is the destruction of life.
Contrast that, if you will, with adult stem cell research. Why is it different? Why is it less problematic? And why are we not hearing about the successes with with the adult stem cell research?
That's another thing that this one article pointed out. Adult stem cell research actually, in certain ways, holds more promise than embryonic stem cell research. In embryonic stem cell research, an embryo is destroyed. In adult stem cell research, you actually take a cell from an adult human body or from umbilical cord blood, from your bone marrow is one source they get it from. And then what they do is they envision adding a chemical to get it to step backwards, to get it to the stem cell stage, and then from there you can maybe grow new heart cells, new spinal cord cells, new pancreas cells if you have diabetes. And a great advantage of the adult stem cells is that there's little rejection problem because it's taken from your own body, whereas embryonic stem cells have the same problem that you would have in transplants. And you would probably have to stay on medication the rest of your life so that you don't reject the cells.
Is that why the advocates of embryonic stem cell research are also advocates of human cloning?
Yes,
I wouldn't be taking it from someone else. I'd be getting it from my own genetic identical twin.
Yes. Yeah. Cloning and stem cell research are really tightly intertwined because there are two basic types of cloning. There's therapeutic cloning and reproductive cloning. And the only difference between the two, really ethically, there isn't that much of a difference. But in reproductive cloning, you create a clone in the laboratory and you allow it to grow up into an infant, allow it to go full term. In therapeutic cloning, what they do is they create a clone in the laboratory and then they will kill it at the 100 cell stage, just like you would in stem cell research, and then they harvest those cells for stem cell treatments.
And it would be your genetic match, therefore they reason no rejection, therefore the best way to go about it.
Right.
Is that how they're thinking about it?
Yeah, that would be one way to do stem cell research, embryonic stem cell research, and still use the DNA from your own body. Right.
It was reported recently, I think last week, in fact, that a research team in South Korea at least is claiming to have had success in cloning the first human embryo. It was not the greatest success in the world because the number had to perish. How significant is that?
It's significant in a way in that it helps the proponents, theoretically the arguments of proponents of human embryonic stem cell research, to be able to use cloning for that. It's kind of odd, and the press has trumpeted that as a great advance in cloning. Well, basically, to get a cell to get to be more mature, well, really they got it to the 100 cell stage, which is about 4 to 7 days along. That's as far as they were able to allow the clone to live. And then they harvested it, and one of the clones they were able to get stem cells from. But it's incredible the waste that went on in that process. There were hundreds of potential embryos that they could have used, and only one of them they were able to harvest successfully a stem cell line from.
So at this point in the technology, if we read in the press, embryonic stem cells can be used to cure things like Parkinson's and diabetes. That is a very premature statement, and also ethically problematic.
Yeah, that's going to be many years away at the earliest. If that would happen, it would take medicine in a completely different direction. Put it that way, they would be able to treat diseases that are not treatable today. But it's problematic because in order to harvest these stem cells, embryos die. And that's the loss of human life for something that could be questionable at best right now is something that's ethically problematic. And in fact, it's an ethical principle that we do not do evil to cause good. And that would be a classical example of doing evil to have a good outcome.
I want to pick up on that in just a moment here. Folks, if you have a question or a comment on bioethics in general or on one of the two subjects we're discussing, both stem cell research, human cloning, and we'll be talking about Terry Schindler-Shivo here in a few minutes, give us a call at 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Our guest is Dr. Kevin Voss. He's instructor of philosophy and director of the Concordia Bioethics Institute at Concordia University, Wisconsin, in Mequon, Wisconsin. Dr. Voss, you led nicely to the whole issue, the real problem in bioethics, not so much the research, but the ethical model that's being used. You said it's a basic moral principle that you don't do evil, that good may result. But there are some very bright lights in bioethics today who are saying, no, you do evil that good may result. You decide whether or not something's good or bad based upon whether a good result will come from it. The end justifies the means. How do you respond to that?
That's one of the fascinating things of studying ethics, is we are able to study different ethical theories. And that ethical theory, the end justifies the means, is called utilitarianism. And utilitarianism can be used in certain situations in life, but when it comes to life and violating the sanctity of human life, we might end up with what we think at the time is a good result, but in reality it isn't. Especially if we believe in biblical principles that are eternal and are there for all time and should not be violated, then we believe it is wrong to violate those principles in order to get what we think is a good outcome. It's sort of a First Commandment issue. We're putting ourselves in the place of God in order to decide what's good for us. And that's against what the Scriptures teach us, that God works in our life, that we are here to serve Him, and that He saves us entirely of what He does and not what we do.
I was talking with, I believe it was one of the leaders of the Christian Medical Association, very recently on the program, and he put the whole human cloning, embryonic stem cell research thing into perspective from a Christian perspective that I thought was intriguing. I like your thoughts on it as well. He says the problem with embryonic stem cell research, the problem with destroying a human embryo for the sake of curing other people, is that God became a human embryo in Jesus Christ. You really run up against one of the central teachings of Christianity, the incarnation of Jesus Christ himself. What do you think about that perspective on when someone says, well, I just don't see why it's such a big deal, why you're so worked up about human cloning or stem cell research?
When we approach an issue like that, there are the two greatest teachings in the Bible are law and gospel. And as Lutherans, that's the way we tend to look at things. And so when we make an ethical decision, we tend to be informed by law and gospel. Law would be, thou shalt not kill. That would be a principle that we would take as a principle we don't violate, or thou shalt not murder, more specifically. But there's also a gospel-based approach, and that's a wonderful gospel-based approach in that what Christ has done for us so motivates everything that we do that we don't want to violate something on this earth in order to risk someone not being able to be witnessed by the gospel, for instance, an embryo. We want to do everything we can to carry out God's will of causing as many people as possible to be saved.
Turning to the issue of Terry Schindler Schiavo, how would you explain this very complicated and troublesome case of a woman down in Florida whose husband would like to see her dead? How would you explain this to a group of students in the classroom here at the university?
In fact, we did have a forum on the Schiavo case last semester, and during a noon hour, and we had some really good discussion on that, and I presented the history of the case, presented various ethical problems, and gave my viewpoint on it. That the case started in 1990, where Terry Schiavo was taken to an emergency room, and it isn't clear still today exactly what happened, but for some reason, either through an accident or through a chemical imbalance in her body, her heart stopped. And her heart stopped long enough in order to cause blood to cease going to her brain longer than what was safe. So out of that, she had some mental deficiencies from that. And we would term her as severely mentally disabled. Others would term her as being in a persistent vegetative state. And that's really one of the moral dilemmas right there. Her husband at first did everything possible to try to get her to recover. Of course, her parents and the rest of her family were behind her and did everything they could. But then a malpractice suit was won against the attending physicians and, I believe, the hospital. And a significant amount of money was awarded. And it's not even clear exactly how much of that money is available yet today, but it seems after that point, which is around 1993, then the husband, who has decision-making, is the decision-maker in this case. When doctors run into a case like this where someone lacks decision-making capacity, as Terry does right now, she can't speak or communicate verbally or directly with someone, then someone is a surrogate decision maker, and the husband is typically the first surrogate decision maker. He decided, at least he brought up the concept or the idea that he thought that it was Terry's wish not to be in a state like this and be kept on medications and tubes for the rest of her life in a disabled state like that. So he petitioned the court to have her tubed, and it was really a feeding tube that was keeping her alive at that point. She can breathe without a respirator, but they have a tube put into her stomach in order to have her get nutrition because she can't swallow and can't chew.
It's a feeding tube. She's right. Getting water and food.
Right. Nutrition and hydration, right.
But what's the difference between what I believe her state to be, which is cognitively disabled, and what Michael Schiavo, her husband and guardian, believes it to be, which is permanent vegetative state? What's the difference there? Why does that make a difference?
medically speaking, there is no test to make someone in a persistent vegetative state. It's a clinical impression. And what the difference is in someone's perception is that if she is in a persistent vegetative state, therefore her quality of life is so terrible that she would not want to live in that state, according to Terry's husband, and so he would see it as medically appropriate to withdraw the treatment, withdraw the feeding tube.
We're talking about dehydrating her and starving her to death.
Yeah, that's how she would die, right? The feeding tube would be removed. They would give her some supportive treatment, maybe ice chips and trying to keep her comfortable, maybe some sedation, but she would die from lack of water and lack of food. And
why,
it'd be a long process, probably a couple weeks.
Why is this case so important?
It's important because in a number of ways. It's important, I think, for Christians in that it's just another evidence of the way that life is devalued in this country, and a life that Christ has redeemed. And so we need to take up, we need to stand up and make a statement about the sanctity of human life and how people should not be devaluated as vegetables just because they suffer some mental deficiencies. And so that's important. It's also important in a medical ethical way because I think for the first time in a long while, people are wondering if the surrogate decision maker plan or strategy that's set up in modern medicine today is really the right way to go. That one decision maker can determine the fate of a person rather than taking into account everyone's feelings in the case, in this case it would be the mother and father.
There are some significant facts that would argue against Michael Schiavo, her husband, being a fit guardian for her life and looking out for her best interest. Wesley Smith, author of the book Culture of Death and Forced Exit, has pointed out on our program, Michael Schiavo has taken up with another woman for the last 7 years. He has children out of wedlock with that woman. He took Terry Schindler's, Schiavo's wedding rings, had them melted down, make a new piece of jewelry for himself.
I didn't even know.
Yes, that's a it's,
and then it's you have the malpractice money too.
Yes,
you know, and what happens to because apparently she has control of some of that money, and if she would pass away, he would get the remainder of that, according to what some people say.
I look at this, and if I'm a judge and I'm impartial, I'm going to say, Michael Schiavo, you do not seem to have the best interests of Terry Schiavo at heart. You seem to have something to gain by her death. Why is it that the judge in this case cannot see that, or will not see that?
Well, and he really represents the feeling of the majority of bioethicists in America. I went to an association of American Society of Bioethics and Humanities meeting, and I would say 95% of the ethicists at that meeting thought that the feeding tube should be removed because he is a surrogate decision maker and he's acting supposedly in her best interest and he should have the final say, period. But we'd have to say there's significant conflicts of interest from his point of view, not only the money. There's also a question, and this hasn't been proven either, how she suffered the injuries to begin with. There's a question that she may be a possible potential victim of abuse, but that hasn't been proven, at least in the public sector, but there have been allegations. So there are some questions there, and I think that's why Governor Jeb Bush sort of put a stay to the whole process of the feeding tube being removed so that everyone could step back and look at the situation and see what's going on there.
We've got about 2 minutes before we need to wrap up our conversation. Dr. Voss, how would you respond to a Christian layperson who approaches you and says, look, these issues of bioethics are just too complicated. They're very hard to figure out. I just don't want to deal with these issues. I'd rather deal with the easy ones. How would you respond?
They all are so significant to our lives, and if they're not now, they will be. Every one of us will die eventually, and the vast majority of us will probably die in a hospital. And so we need to know, we need to stick up for the sanctity of human life right now so that it translates in what would happen to us when we wind up in that situation. And as far as bioethics in, topics being hard to understand, that's part of the mission of the Concordia Bioethics Institute, is to help people understand the scientific, philosophical, and medical issues and theological issues involved in some of these cases, and trying to make it clear to people, because these issues are so important, you need really need to understand them, because they will affect your life. If they don't won't now, they'll at least affect someone else you know, or they will affect you in the future.
Dr. Kevin Voss, thank you for being our guest.
You're welcome.
Dr. Kevin Voss is instructor of philosophy and director of the Concordia Bioethics Institute at Concordia University here in Mequon, Wisconsin. By the way, you can check out the website for the Concordia Bioethics Institute by going first to our website, issuesetc.org, issuesetc.org. When you get there, click on the links with regular guests link, and you'll find a direct link to the Concordia Bioethics Institute. Tomorrow on the program, we're going to have a two-hour conversation with Dr. Carl Fikencher, a two-hour conversation you do not want to miss on law and gospel. That's tomorrow on Issues Etc. We'll return to Issues Etc. live in St. Louis Monday for those who are looking forward to that. Lincoln was struggling with an issue of who is human, who do we call human, during his presidency. He had a brilliant way of approaching this when it came to people, the African Americans in the United States. He says if you can deny someone the status of being a human or a person on the basis of their skin color, that they're darker than you, then anyone who has lighter skin than you can also deny you the same recognition. If you can deny them because they seem to be less educated, then anyone more educated than you can deny you the same distinction. And I think this applies beautifully to the situation of Terry Schindler Schiavo or the embryo in the test tube or the womb. If we would deny them the status of protection under the law and the dignity of life, if we would do that, then anyone bigger than us, in the case of the embryo, more developed than us, in the case of the embryo, or anyone more capable than us, as in the case of Terry Schindler Schiavo, can deny us precisely the same dignity. Tune in tomorrow to Issues Etc. for that two-hour conversation on law and gospel. And as we sign off here, thanks to Angus Manouge and to the Cronach Institute for inviting us up here to Concordia University, Wisconsin, in Mequon, Wisconsin. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.